Welcome to the World War I History Podcast, produced by the MacArthur Memorial. We invite you to follow us on Twitter at MacArthur1880 or find the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial on Facebook. America's path to World War I was complicated. Although committed to a nominal policy of neutrality for most of the war, the pre-war years for America involved an internal battle over the nation's future. Most could agree that America should have a more dynamic international role, but that meant different things to different people. And it wasn't just a debate between the traditional interests or political parties. Powerful progressive forces splintered over the nation's response to World War I. Today, we're going to discuss America's entry into that war in the context of this debate. And we are joined by Dr. Neil Langto, author of The Approaching Storm, Roosevelt, Wilson, Adams, and Their Clash Over America's Future. Welcome, Dr. Langto.
Thank you for having me.
So your book starts off in 1912. And why is 1912 so significant? And how would you describe America's national trajectory prior to 1914?
Well, it's the heart of the progressive era. And I started the book with the Progressive Convention, the new Progressive Party Convention that was the new party that was established by Theodore Roosevelt that year. And it was a way to provide a jumping off point for these three figures that were going to be discussed in the book, who were all giants of the progressive era: Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Jane Addams. And at the Progressive Convention, the book begins with Jane Addams seconding the nomination of Theodore Roosevelt at this convention. It was a very exciting time for those who leaned progressive in 1912, because the country really seemed to be in a reform mood. You know, the major candidates that year, three of the four, were on the liberal to left liberal side of things. There's a quote in the book where William Jennings Bryan said something like 70-80% of the country is progressive at this time. So the mood was reform, and that seemed to be very prominent at the time. But what's going to happen is the European War in 1914 is going to interrupt that mood in the United States. And as you mentioned, it's going to splinter parts of the progressive movement in different directions.
Now, you focus on Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Jane Addams. Can you give us a brief bio of each and explain why you chose them to tell this story about America's path to World War I?
There are three fascinating people. And they were all the same generation. They were all born in the 1850s within a few years of each other. They're all progressives, and they all knew one another. So that was what brought me to choose them as the leading figures in this book. But we'll talk about each one individually, where they were in 1912. I mean, Roosevelt, of course, had made his name, you know, someone who had been president in the past, had been president between 1901 to 1909. He had been a reformer. He's someone who the American public had been fascinated with for years, you know, with the Rough Riders and he was, you know, his various exploits. But as he moved farther to the left, the Republican Party was finding him a little bit more difficult to deal with. And when Roosevelt tried to become president again in 1912 and get the nomination from the Republicans blocked him from getting that. So he started this new party, the Progressive Party, which seemed to be exemplifying just about everything that the progressive wanted. It was, you know, championing women's suffrage and labor laws and the end of child labor and minimum wages. It was really far ahead of its time what they were pushing for at the time. But Roosevelt was still a giant figure in American politics in 1914. He was someone that the public was fascinated with, not just as a politician, but as a person. He was a genuine celebrity who people really were drawn to still, even though he was no longer president. Now, Wilson was a different person altogether. Wilson's personality was very different from Roosevelt's. You know, Roosevelt was very into manliness and hunting and war and things like that, whereas that was not Woodrow Wilson. Wilson was an academic who had made his success early on teaching, first at Princeton, later was made the president of Princeton University. And from there, he was enticed to go into politics as a Democrat in New Jersey, which was a big shock. And he got elected governor, which no one thought was going to happen. And from there, he got nominated for president in 1912. So he had a very, very quick jump into the political arena successfully, was a progressive, not as concerned with social reforms as Roosevelt was at that point. He was more concerned about things like the trust and the big business things. And that was a big part of his message when he ran in 1912. And finally, there's Jane Addams, who is probably the least well-known to your listeners today, although I think she deserves to be better known. In 1912, she was very famous. She was probably one of the most famous women in America in 1912. She had made her name by establishing Hull House in Chicago, a settlement house which ministered to the poor in the immigrant communities in Chicago. And from there, she became involved in all kinds of social worker efforts, but also various reform causes by the early 20th century. Yeah, so she was very, very much venerated by the turn of the century in America and was quite respected as a woman who was a do-gooder. But the American public was comfortable with her in that role, but they were not as comfortable when she got involved in things that were a little more controversial. Pacifism, which becomes her great cause during World War I. Things like civil rights sometimes attracted some controversy, and she was very involved in that. And also, when she gets involved in politics, the idea was that she should be above politics. You know, she should be just a do-gooding reformer and reforming woman and not get involved in partisan politics, but she does. So she's someone who was really in the midst of this. She was a very significant progressive figure at this time. And as I said, probably one of the most well-known women in America in 1912, maybe second to Helen Keller. It's hard to believe now because I think Jane Addams is quite forgotten. Every time I do an interview for this book, most people ask me, who's Jane Addams? I don't know who she is. She really should be known as someone who's really ahead of her time, far more advanced in her views than either Roosevelt or Wilson in many areas.
1914, war breaks out in Europe. How do these three progressives respond?
Well, Wilson's in the White House, of course, and Wilson's dealing with a lot of issues. His wife is dying when he comes in. When the war begins. So his wife is dying at this moment. He's trying to figure out what he should do. His natural instinct is that America should stay out. That has always been our way. But that doesn't mean he's kind of pulling away completely. His belief and his hope is that at some point America will be able to provide service as some sort of perhaps mediator or to bring the powers together and to play some sort of role in the peace process in the future. But for now, he believes that America should be neutral. That is his instinct in the fall of 1914, in the summer and fall of 1914. Roosevelt originally agreed with Woodrow Wilson at the time, but very soon afterwards, probably by the end of 1914, he came to believe that Wilson had totally botched things and that Wilson should have protested at the bare minimum what the Germans were doing, particularly the invasion of Belgium. Recently, this last week, I wrote an op-ed, which appeared in the Chicago Tribune, about the parallels between the invasion of Belgium in 1914 and our response to that and the invasion of Ukraine in 2022. And Joe Biden and Woodrow Wilson kind of faced with the same issue. What is our responsibility? What do we do? And what will the American public stand for? And I think Wilson probably was correct in 1914 in thinking that the American public would not stand for more than sympathy. Roosevelt, as I said, came to believe that we should have done more, if not go to war, but at least formally denounce what had been done in Germany, what the German attack on Belgium in 1914. And that was just the beginning of the ongoing feud between Roosevelt and Wilson between 1914 and 17. For Adams, I think she was absolutely shocked. A lot of Americans were shocked. They couldn't believe that there was this kind of war in the 20th century. That seemed like Napoleonic times. You know, it just seemed like we're beyond that now. We've been working towards all kinds of these international instruments that can prevent war. And here we are having this global catastrophe unfolding. She was very upset because she believed it was going to roll back progressivism and roll back reform. That once countries become militarized and become so involved in the war, that all kinds of reforms will be just pushed aside. Her instinct immediately is that America needs to do something to find a way to bring the powers to the peace table. And that becomes her major cause between 1914 and 1917, is to keep nudging and pushing Wilson to do something to get these countries talking so we can stop the fighting and bring about peace. And America should be behind that effort. That's what she's advocating.
By 1915, the Germans are really losing the propaganda war. You have the Lusitania, you have British reports coming out about atrocities happening in Belgium. How do Roosevelt, Wilson, and Adams respond in this critical year?
Well, when the Lusitania was sunk in May of 1915, that really was a pivotal moment. I think it was a wake-up call for Americans who thought that the war was not going to touch them. When the Lusitania was sunk, I think 128 Americans or something like that were killed. Over 100 were killed. And the country was up in arms when the news came through. I think Wilson, you know, had a lot of pressure on him, put on him at the time that he should do more. He should go to war. His advisor, Colonel House, is on him saying, you know, if you don't at least break ties with Germany, you'll lose the support of Europe. You'll lose the respect of Europe. He has people in his cabinet telling him the same thing. And a few days after the Lusitania sinking, he gave this speech in Philadelphia where everyone was waiting to see what Wilson was going to say. And he said during this speech that there's such a thing as a man who is too proud to fight. And there's such a thing as a country which is too proud to fight. And that was sort of his thought at the time. It signaled to the country that we're not going to war over this. And I think when most people calmed down, they felt that that was the right thing. Roosevelt, of course, was appalled. It's funny, at the time, he was in the middle of fighting for his political life. He was being sued for libel in New York at the time. And he gets the news of this, and he's just appalled. And he said something at the time saying, there's things worse than war. You know, country's self-respect is just as important. So he felt, again, this was just another sign of Wilson waffling. But I think the issue, of course, was our military could not have done much anyway at the time because our army was so small. It was about 100,000. So if Wilson said, okay, let's go to war with Germany over this, there was very little we could do at that moment in time, which becomes another issue for Roosevelt, which I think we'll get to in a moment, about the issue of preparedness. For Adams at that time was in Europe. She had gone over as a representative of the Women's Peace Party to meet with other women at a women's conference, women's congress to talk about peace. And she was in the midst of visiting different countries. And when she got the news of the Lusitania, and she was very happy the way Wilson handled it, she felt that Wilson was doing the most proper thing, which was to keep us out and that we would be able to accomplish more staying out of this war if we could. So she, at that point, I think, really believed that Woodrow Wilson was her man and begins to get closer to him, begins to talk to him more and visit with him in the White House because she thinks that he thinks the same way as far as pacifism is concerned in America's role.
So the next year of the war, 1916, the preparedness movement is growing in the United States, and Wilson signs the National Defense Act that will help prepare the United States for war. But he's also reelected on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." Roosevelt wants war. Adams clearly doesn't want war. Is Wilson's position evolving on the issue?
I think Wilson still didn't want war, but I do think he had been influenced by the preparedness movement, which Roosevelt had been trumpeting since about 1914, 15. This idea that we have to build up our defenses in this country, if not for this war, but for the next war. And I think Roosevelt's ultimate idea was if we're going to accomplish anything around the globe and be able to intervene when other countries are attacked, we need to have a sufficient enough military apparatus in place to do something, to accomplish anything. And I think Wilson understood that by early 1916, because Wilson had jumped on the preparedness bandwagon by 1916. As you mentioned, legislation finally got through that year. I don't think that meant that Wilson wanted to put us in the war. I think he still wanted to find any possible way to keep us out if he could. I mean, he practically was his own Secretary of State after Bryan was kind of pushed out and Bryan resigned in 1915, William Jennings Bryan. And I think he did everything possible to keep us out. I mean, there were numerous provocations, which I won't get into now, but with the Sussex in the spring of 1916, where it really looked like after the Sussex was sunk, we were going to go to war. And Wilson pretty much laid down the law. So if you don't back down with the submarine warfare, we're going to split diplomatically. And that, of course, will lead to war. The Germans didn't want that. So that was the one of the most important things, that the Germans were willing to placate the United States to keep us out of war. But I think by late 1916, Wilson could see they're not going to do this forever. The Germans also understood we can't win a long war. We have to wrap up this war relatively quickly. So if America, if you're going to do something for peace, do it now, because if you don't, we're going to resume unrestricted submarine warfare. And that's what Wilson was well aware of. So I think he was hoping that there would be a way out to prevent us from having to go to war by late 1916.
Next year of the war, how do we get from Wilson's peace without victory speech in January 1917 to him asking Congress for a declaration of war in early April 1917? And is entry into the war the end of the debate between the three progressive giants that you've been talking about?
Well, Wilson had tried. He did finally try to launch a peace effort in December 1916. You know, sort of let's Can we talk? You know, try and get both sides to at least talk, get them maybe to the peace table. That effort failed, but he did not give up. He still believed, you know, he was still willing to try to find any way to get the two sides to stop fighting and maybe get them somehow to begin at least negotiating or something. What happened to force Wilson's hand was the Germans. The Germans had decided once these peace things didn't really do much of anything, they said, okay, well, we have to win the war this year. They said, we have to win the war in 1917. And to win the war this year, we have to throw off all the restraints on the submarines. You know, they had restricted them to placate the United States, but they no longer were willing to do that. So in early 1917, the decision was made, we're going to resume unrestricted submarine warfare. And they realized this is probably going to bring the United States into the war. But the feeling was among the higher-ups in Germany, particularly the military and the Navy people, even if it brings the United States in, it will be too late for them to make a difference. They won't be able to get a significant force across the ocean for months. And by then, we will have successfully starved out the British with our submarine policy. That's what they believed. So once they inform Wilson that they're going to resume unrestricted submarine warfare, Wilson immediately said, okay, we have to split diplomatically with the Germans. That was the first step. I think at that point, Wilson was still hoping that the Germans would not push it further than this, but it was clear they were no longer going to back down. And then you have the Zimmermann telegram, the infamous Zimmermann telegram, which was a crazy scheme that was cooked up in early 1917. It had been brewing even before that, basically where the proposal was made to Mexico that if Germany goes to war with the United States, if the Mexican make trouble for the United States on the border, maybe even invade America, we Germany will allow you to take territory you had lost in America years before from the Mexican-American War, places like parts of American states. It was an absolutely crazy scheme. I had no hope of ever being successful. The Mexican government was already under so much chaos. They could barely manage their own affairs right now. It was the idea they were going to be able to take territory from the United States. But the British intercepted this particular cable and eventually turned it over to the Americans. The Wilson administration leaked it. When it went out to the public, a lot of Americans were even more upset and more feeling that war was a possibility, if not desirable. But even then, I would say that died down fairly quickly. This is not like World War II. World War I is very different in the sense that I think much of the American population would have probably tolerated Wilson not going to war in April 1917. I think the biggest thing for Wilson, maybe the biggest motivator, was Wilson's own desire to have an impact on the peace and on the future of the world. And I think he understood that unless America got involved in this war, he wasn't going to have much of a say. And there's a scene in the book where Adams goes to visit Wilson in early 1917. And he tells her this. He says, if we don't get involved in the war, I'll be lucky to get into the peace conference through a crack in the door. And he did not feel that was acceptable. And that was very discouraging to Adams. I think at that point she realized Wilson was not quite the pacifist she thought he was. And I think that was somewhat of a disillusionment for her at that point. So I think all of these factors were swirling around in Wilson's mind. Then you have additional American ships being sunk in March 1917. So he felt there was nowhere else to go but to go to war. And I think he was ready, as I said, ready to do it because he felt it had to be done. It was distasteful to him, but he felt for the good of the world, and I guess the good of the peace, it was necessary for us to be involved in this war.
My feelings about Wilson, I think, are always so complicated. I mean, it's clear he had an incredibly difficult job, that he tried to do it in the best way that he could. But you know, I guess I wonder sometimes if his policy and his shifts in 1917 and the decision to go to war is him merely responding to maybe a growing consensus among the American people that war would be okay, and his desire to be involved in the peace process that he foresees after the war, or if he is leading everybody towards this just out of a sense that this is what we have to do. You know, is he following the tide of public opinion and his desire to be involved in the peace process, or is he leading out front saying America just has to do this because this is what we have to do?
It's an interesting question. I think if Teddy Roosevelt were here with us, he would say that Wilson was nothing but a political chameleon following what the people wanted. I don't necessarily agree, because I think Wilson at times took very unpopular stands. And I do think that in the spring of 1917, if Wilson had said, we are not going to go to war over this. We're just going to, we'll arm our ships, you know, we'll achieve what we wanted to do, but we're not going to send troops over and we'll just continue what we're doing. I think much of the American public would have probably been cool with that, with the exception of the East Coast. So the East Coast was the most rabidly supportive of the Allies. But I think when you start getting to the Midwest, you start getting to the far West, a lot of Americans still couldn't see that the provocations had been sufficient enough to require us to get involved in this incredibly bloody, destructive war that had taken the lives of millions of people. So the interesting thing, the vote in Congress was, I think, 372 to 50 or something like that for war. But there were people who said at the time, if it had been a secret ballot, it would have been much closer than this. There was ambivalence. And as I said, I think Wilson could have survived politically if he wanted to hold off on going to war. He would, of course, been bludgeoned by the Roosevelts of the world, but I think the pacifists would have been quite excited about it. And I think Americans were ambivalent until the war started for America, and then the propaganda machine got geared up. And then everyone became war to end all wars, Germans are brutes, Kaiser must be killed, that type of thing. And people got very, very excited about the war and really turned into super patriots to an extreme fashion. But I think it's different from World War II, where I do think the country in World War II was very much, yes, we have to go to war, we have to be attacked by the Japanese, there was no question. World War I, it was definitely a difficult situation. And I do think, as I said a couple of times, Wilson had the opportunity to keep us out if he wanted to, but he did not want to.
Interesting. All right. So at this point, Roosevelt has his war, but now he wants to be in the war. And he's going to write to Secretary of War Newton Baker. And this is a really interesting part of your book. He says that basically, as former Commander-in-Chief, President of the United States, he is eligible for any command that the War Department will give him. And he also visits Wilson to plead his case. Now, there were probably some good reasons to let Roosevelt go to Europe, but there were also some potential drawbacks. Can you tell us a little bit about this, and what is the final decision on whether Roosevelt is going to be allowed to go over?
It is one of my favorite parts in the book, I have to say. It's sad, but also it's fascinating just to see this unfold. I mean, Roosevelt was, there's no other word, obsessed about going over. He wanted to go over. He wanted to go over and die. He's even said, I think it would be a perfect way to end my life would be to go over and die for my country. And he had been raising this division for about a year, maybe more. It had thousands of people who were ready to go and serve, kind of like the Rough Riders in the Spanish-American War. And as you mentioned, he's been engaging in this back and forth with Newton Baker, the Secretary of War, about this. And Baker is he deftly kind of bats him away, throws up little barriers, but no matter what, Roosevelt has an answer back to him. And like, as you said, he even says, well, I'm a former Commander-in-Chief, so I should be able to have any position I desire. And he's determined enough that he goes to see Wilson, the man he had hated and detested and been bashing for years. And he goes to the White House and talks to Wilson, and they have a nice little chat. I would love to have been a fly on the wall to see that conversation, to see Roosevelt and Wilson talking. And Wilson doesn't say yes, doesn't say no. But afterwards, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, people swirling around Wilson, what he should do, what he shouldn't do. There are a couple of things I think that were pushing Wilson never to let him go. The military themselves did not want him over there, did not want Roosevelt over there. They thought he would be a nuisance. He'd be running around telling people what to do because he was a former Commander-in-Chief. So I think they didn't really want him there. They didn't want these volunteer units either this time. They felt those were more trouble than they were worth during the Spanish-American War. So they didn't want that either. Roosevelt was in no shape to go. That was something Roosevelt himself never seemed to deal with. He was not someone who was taking care of himself. His health had not been in great shape the last few years. So he was really, really not well. And I think then there was a practical side of, if I'm a Woodrow Wilson Democratic president, do I allow my great rival, who might run against me in 1920? There was already talk that Wilson was going to go for a third term in 1920, and it was going to be a Wilson-Roosevelt competition in 1920. I'm going to let my future opponent go to Europe and maybe do something heroic and become, you know, even bigger than he already is. Like, why would I do that? Some Democrats said, let him go. He'll be better off over there than screaming and complaining and criticizing in the United States. But Wilson said, no, he's not going. Newton Baker always claimed it was his decision, not Wilson's. I found some correspondence Baker wrote later on. And he said, it wasn't really Wilson. It was me. And I felt he was simply unqualified to go. Simple as that. That's why he didn't go. But of course, that embittered Roosevelt incredibly. It just made the rest of his life even more sad. Of course, his sons did go over and fight, and he lost one of his sons, Quentin, during World War One.
I just found that an absolutely fascinating part of the book and part of that Roosevelt-Wilson relationship.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been so uncomfortable for them to see each other. As I said, they used to be friends back in the day. I say close buddy friends, but they were quite collegial, they corresponded in the early 1900s. And Roosevelt was happy that Wilson was made president of Princeton. So they at one point had a decent relationship, but then it just became worse and worse to the point where they both men detested each other. And Wilson would never respond to Roosevelt's criticisms, which drove Roosevelt up the wall, because Roosevelt wanted to kind of slug it out and kind of throw mud at each other. But Wilson would just ignore him. And Wilson even said, "I know that bothers him even more if I say nothing." So he intentionally would say nothing.
It is a very brief war for the United States compared to the other warring powers. It ends in November 1918. Do you think, had Roosevelt, Wilson, and Adams all been younger, healthier, do you think their next big battle would have been over the Versailles Treaty and over the general peace that followed?
I think so. I think if Roosevelt had lived, Roosevelt would have probably been fighting the League of Nations the way that his close friend Henry Cabot Lodge did. There's very late in life, right before Roosevelt died. Roosevelt died right after the war ended. He died in January 1919. And he said something to the effect that, well, the League of Nations, it might be okay if we don't expect it to do too much, but we have other things that are much more important than this. I think he would have insisted that changes be made to it, as Lodge did, particularly, the famous article which might have committed us around the globe. So I think that would have been a big fight. And again, this could have led up to a battle in 1920 if they both Wilson and Roosevelt, their health had held out. There could have been a great presidential battle in 1920 over the issue of the League of Nations. Adams was not happy with the Treaty of Versailles, and she was someone who immediately felt it was going to be problematic, that the conditions that were imposed by the Allies were going to lead to serious issues in the future. She had a tough time after the war in general. During the 1920s, there was really just a backlash against any kind of people who were considered to be on the left or who had challenged the official party line during the war. I mean, during the 20s, you have the FBI keeping tabs on her and showing up at some of her meetings. You have the ROTC calling her the most dangerous woman in America. And this is a woman now who's 70 years old, and they're calling her, close to 70, calling her the most dangerous woman in America. By the 1930s, late 20s, early 30s, when Americans start to have a real second thoughts about World War One and that it may have been a great mistake, then you start seeing the anger towards Adams dissipating and a lot of respect returning to her, such that she gets the Nobel Peace Prize late in life in the early 30s, and she becomes a beloved figure again. And I think that's because Americans in general came to see World War One as a great mistake, which of course poses problems for Franklin and Roosevelt when World War II starts getting close to happening, because Americans felt they'd been burned 20 years earlier and had been led into a war they did not think was necessary, and we should avoid the same thing in World War II. And of course, World War II is a totally different situation, but that's something that Roosevelt Franklin was up against at the time.
Any final thoughts?
I think the book has a lot to offer readers. You know, it's a story of how we get involved in this war. And I think it's one of the most important decisions, because I think our decision to get involved in the war changed the trajectory of the war. If we don't get involved, it's possible the war turns out differently. And the fact that we did get involved, it allowed the Allies to defeat Germany, which leads to the Treaty of Versailles and all kinds of other issues, which leads to a second global war 20 years later. So I think that's a really important decision for America. But the book is also, it's a character study of three individuals, three very fascinating individuals. It's also a story of America at this time. There's a lot of material in the book about what's happening in the United States. You know, the polio epidemic of 1916. I talk about that Charlie Chaplin craze. So it's a story of a very interesting period in American life we don't know that much about. And I throw in a lot of side characters who I think might be interesting to your listeners, like Henry Ford's in there as one of the peace people, and you have Colonel House, who was Wilson's close confidant, and Rosica Schwimmer, who was this leading pacifist who was way ahead of her time. So it's a lot of different people in this book, all telling this story, but also it's a snapshot of American life, I think, between 1914 and 17. So hopefully people will enjoy it.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Langto, for joining us today and for sharing about this research.
Thank you again for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening.
If you have questions, suggestions, or comments, we want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at MacArthur1880, on Facebook as the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial, or you can email MacArthurMemorial@norfolk.gov.